Bright Rags is ringing in the new year with an all-new collection for Rob Zombie's House of a Thousand Corpses, featuring new t-shirts and enamel pins, plus reprints of classic designs and socks. Officially licensed and available on Tuesday, January 14th. Also stay tuned Thursday, January 16th for a special four-day pre-order event featuring a brand new t-shirt celebrating horror icon John Carpenter's birthday. Available exclusively at fright-rags.com. Shockwaves listeners get 10% off their first order using SHOCK2020 at checkout. You will not want to miss that four-day pre-order of the John Carpenter t-shirt. I don't know if you guys have seen it yet, but it's John Carpenter in all his glory, surrounded by all his icons, and it is one hell of a way to celebrate the Master of Horror's birthday.
Your homepage for horror is here. Fangoria.com is now live and brimming with the digital horror content that you crave. Fangoria.com is your first destination for all the horror news of the day, featuring a constant curation of the Fango team's favorite links from across the internet. They're taking the time to aggregate the most important news in horror in one space to save you the time and sanity. You'll also find long-form pieces, deep dives, and daily thoughts from the biggest names in horror, as well as exclusive access to the Fangoria Vault. Right now, all current subscribers to the magazine are automatically members of Fangoria.com. And as promised, the content in the new issues will forever be print-only. If you're not a subscriber, check out the new Fangoria.com for yourself and see the horror right before your eyes. Use the promo code SHOCKWAVES for 15% off right now.
Everyone, and welcome to Shockwaves. I'm your co-host, Dr. Rebecca McKendry. I had to throw that in since I was doing the intro tonight, guys. Do you like that?
That was fresh.
Yeah, that was real fresh. That was some sass there. I am joined tonight by my co-host, Ryan Turek.
Hello.
How's it going?
I feel nice and fresh.
Because of the hard soap?
The hard soap did that.
The hard soap of last week's episode kept me nice and clean. Kept all my... Never mind.
You feeling clean?
I am good, but I realize because we've reversed our order here, we'll never know because neither none.
No,
none
no, no. You can't talk yet because I'm not done
okay,
yet.
Okay.
So anyway, what about me? Okay. Oh yeah, Elric Kane.
Elric Kane's like here too.
What episode is it?
One.
You're probably the only one who even would know.
172.
Boom.
Yeah. You guys asked me to do the intro. That's not gonna happen. It's gonna be like one.
First episode of 2020, baby.
172. Rob G. How is it going, Rob? Just premiered or not premiered? You had a casting crew screening.
Yes,
of
a
Analog
private
Love.
Private screening.
It was amazing.
My doc, yes, which is not horror themed, but maybe people out there that grew up loving things like VHS, the analog, will enjoy it. So
I posted up on Instagram today the Memorex tape and the memory that I had a pack of those, and I had to just continuously listen to the radio till Color Me Bad's I Want to Sex You Up came on because my mom wouldn't let me buy the single. And so I still somewhere at my parents' house had that Memorex tape with I Want to Sex You Up on it.
Well,
so.
I told Ciara had her own mixtape story as we were walking out of the theater last night, and I had my own, which was...
I love that everybody has a story.
Oh, God, yeah.
Well, mine, this one dissuaded me from ever making a mixtape again, but I was picked up by two older girls in my high school. One of them was my best friend's sister.
No.
They would pick me up on the way to school and drive me to school.
Okay.
Yeah. I was getting
your
there.
Your escorts.
I was getting
school.
There, yeah. And they were two like kind of heavy metal babes, and I deeply admired both of them. And I was like, you know what? I really like one of them. And I made a mixtape, and I was like, okay, I'm going to lead with Def Leppard's Polaroid. A photograph. I'm sorry.
I was
photograph.
Gonna say,
no. I'm always thinking about Polaroid.
Def Leppard fan.
I was looking at I put photograph at the top. And I remember one morning, because they would always put on mixtapes, and I remember getting in the car, being very proud of myself. And I was like, Def Leppard's photograph. And they were like, Ryan, what'd you got? And I was like, mixtape for you guys, based on your love of like rock and heavy metal. Mm-hmm. And I put it in, and the opening licks of Def Leppard's photograph come on, and they both were like, oh God, oh no, oh, and they like ejected the tape and gave it right back
to me. Is Def Leppard too lame for them?
Yeah.
Yeah, because I remember that in my high school, there was the metalheads that listened to Slayer and Metallica. Yeah. But if you liked any of the hair metal bands, even Motley Crue was not cool enough.
I was a wee freshman, and I was just shamed.
Leopard, I mean, like Pyromania hit, I think I was in fifth or sixth grade.
Yeah.
So yeah, that they were cool then. But yeah, by the time I got into high school, it was Slayer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's no shame in the Leopard in adult life.
Absolutely not. No.
Ryan,
no, I still
listen. I would have liked you.
Thank you.
Elric would have appreciated that.
Elric's probably never heard a Def Leppard song.
I was a fan from a young age.
Yeah.
So we have a super exciting show tonight. So a couple of weeks ago, I was on Attack of the Queer Wolves. And I was on there with Darren Stein, which was like total fangirl moment for me because he directed Jawbreaker. Mm. Love that movie so much. Yeah. And while I was there, we were talking about kind of camp and horror and how the two intersect. And he was like, have you seen the show Dragula? Mm. And at the time, I had not. And I was like, tell me of this Dragula. And he sent me links to it on Netflix and was like, oh, you need to watch
it. No association to Rob Zombie's
song. None whatsoever. It is a show that started out on YouTube and then kind of expanded and then expanded even more. And now you can see season 2 and 3 on Netflix. And the whole basis of the show is on three tenants of filth, horror, and glamour, and which I love. And it is a drag show in kind of the traditional sense where it's people who they get a concept and then they have to kind of embody it and come up with a character and a costume and a persona and oftentimes a stage performance. But they always have to include those tenets of filth, horror, and glamour. And it is so horror nerdy.
It pushes the Project Runway model
completely
to new extremes. But Becca turned me onto this show a couple months back, and it is hard not to become fascinated by the inner workings of the drag world and the drama that comes out of it and the creativity most of all.
Yeah.
But I am very, very excited to meet our two guests tonight.
Yes, we have Drakmordia and Swan Thula, the Boulay brothers, joining us tonight.
Amazing.
Drak and Swan for
sure. I cannot wait. Well, I'm looking forward to that.
Are they going to judge us harshly based on...
Probably.
They're totally going to judge your outfit.
I want to be judged on filth.
I wore the Gorezone shirt today.
And
so
I wore horror.
No. All right.
The show, I love how nerdy it gets. Like, there was episodes where they're like, your outfit's very Jean Roland. And you never hear that on any other show.
No, there's like horror deep cuts really fun.
By the time you get to the third season, the winner, who is actually a king, a drag king, Landon Sider did this whole like how would I say it? HP Lovecraft, like it was very cool, like Reanimator one.
Yeah.
It's super deep cutty.
Yeah.
So
the
I'm
beginning
excited.
Of season 3, and I'd love to confirm this later on when we're on the show, is I believe a nod to the opening of Halloween 4 when Myers attacks the two paramedics inside the ambulance and there's two of them under a sheet, and you just see this clawed hand with these very long fingernails take out a paramedic in the ambulance, and then you see the ambulance later on. But I was like, oh, that's a little Michael Myers-esque.
Cool.
Yeah,
there's a lot to love. So I'm really excited to talk to them about the show and find out everything, the interworkings of it.
Yeah, it's going to be a blast.
But first, what'd you guys watch? We've had a long
homework.
Break.
We had homework. Ryan gave us homework,
well,
and
we all
did it.
We can also talk about changes to the format, minor changes, just so people are
in
aware.
In 2020,
we're going to try a couple minor things.
We
want to
freshen it up. Yeah. Freshen it up with the hard soap.
Yeah.
People who never listen to
that anymore, so.
Yeah. Right, I'm giving you a copy of Hard Soap for your birthday.
Please.
You're going to be like, enjoy.
It's actually called Hard Soap, Hard Soap.
Yes.
Twice. We're talking about a vinegar syndrome. Movie that they're putting out.
Double the hardness, double the soap.
That we had to talk about in an ad.
Yeah.
but we're talking about a Vinegar Syndrome release today, and it's the 1986 release of Spookies.
Right, so what we were just saying, we were going to change the format.
Yes.
And the format change is going to be we're going to talk about one film in common at the start of each episode.
Yes.
That is the dream.
Yeah.
At least one. I think we have two tonight,
don't we? Might, but we have at least
one. Okay.
Yeah. And I think that's just a great way to start on the same page. But this one is one that I saw it on YouTube for the first time this year, earlier.
I've never seen it at all.
I did it as a pick for my Horror All Nighters for the other show I did. And it got me really excited because it kind of... Even though it's, there's lots of questionable things about it, but it does have a ton of different monsters. So it reminds me, which gets me excited. It brings out the Halloween
monsters,
kids.
Monsters it definitely has. Rob, did you ever see this on VHS?
I do not remember this at all. The first time I heard about it was maybe 2 years ago. Some label put out the soundtrack on vinyl.
Yes.
And it was such an obscure – I was like, wait, what is this? Like, yeah. Why is that?
And it's a really
cool
soundtrack.
Yeah, no, the music's cool. But then you heard about – when the soundtrack came out, then I dug into the story behind it and the idea that I guess producers hired these directors to make them film and they didn't like it. So they hired another director to
reshoot –
An entire subplot.
Yeah, so there's the documentary, which is has multiple on this. I didn't get through it all, but yeah, before I saw the movie, I came across this article that a lot of people were sharing by The Dissolve called The Strange Saga of Spookies, and it's one of the best just breakdowns of movies I've read in years where it just
Please share it on our Facebook page.
And it goes through the legal. And so literally there's these young friends who had their dream to make a horror film, and it was going to be kind of like a high-end horror film, which once you see Spookies, we know the result. And they meet this British producer who made a ton of money by being the guy who got to release all of the video nasties in England. Mm. So he had the rights to them. So he was making a fortune because everyone was banning them. Right. He was finding ways to show them. So he took that money. He basically gets these guys and says, actually, I want to make something. Can you give me something a little bit more mainstream?
Yeah.
They shoot a movie for him. He then locks them out of the edit
and
then hires a director who had done a lot of porn, I guess, and the lead actress from some of that porn who becomes this total other storyline. But I will say, I don't notice that first time I watch this movie.
Oh, yeah.
Are you serious? Never
I really don't. Like, not the first time. When I first watch it, I'm kind of like, oh, cool.
You mean the shoehorned subplot? Yeah, I have no idea. Yeah.
But once you know, you can't unknow.
Yeah, maybe it was because I knew it from the start that I was like, oh, this is a hot mess.
Yeah.
So I had no prep for this. Like, all I knew is that this was our homework. And on Saturday of last weekend, Elric and I took our collective broods of children to go see My Neighbor Totoro. And,
which is
similar. The
new to totally Miyazaki, similar to
but while there, he hands me Spookies and he goes, we have to watch this for this week. So I go home and I pop it in and I was watching it for 10 minutes and I think I left to use the bathroom and I came back and there was a werecat dressed as a pirate cuddling someone.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I love the werecat.
I had to text Elric and
when
be like,
you wrote to me and said, what is this weird werewolf? And I had to correct you by saying, no, it's a werecat.
I said werewolf with a hook hand. And then you were like, no, it's a werecat.
Because I say that in the commentary, it's like they're like a werecat. I'm like, you would never know it's a werecat.
Oh, I totally knew it was a werecat.
Yeah.
I mean, like, it's very clear, Elric, that he's got a very feline face. He just has a hook for a head.
But let's just say
he is dressed like a pirate. He's
the greatest thing about this movie.
Attire.
And if I could ask anyone on Earth any question, it'd be, how the fuck did these characters know each other? I have never seen a movie where the lead group least should
so
be
we've
together.
Got
the two
cars. The 50s greasers, and then we've got the 80s porn
Sam Waterston,
star, who somehow
suddenly a Sam Waterston, Charlie Rose type.
The guy's
this
constant hinting
that she may take her top off at some point, but it never happens. Yeah. Don't get excited.
That was a producer thing. They wanted to keep it PG-13, so that was one of the things was to cut out anything too sexual.
Yeah, it's very kind of like, is she?
In terms of kiss. Establishing characters, you have no idea who you're following or what the interactions or the relationships are amongst the, I think there's five or six people total. But I mean, like, the movie is basically about these five or six people who are heading from a disastrous gathering, from what I'm picking up on based on a dialogue. And they wind up at this house where in the bowels of this house is this kind of decrepit old guy.
I thought he was supposed to be kind of phantasm-like. Like, he definitely, for me, had, like, he's nods like
something,
of Tall
they
Man.
They call him a sorcerer at some point.
Supernatural at some point.
He was like Tall Man meets Dark Shadows.
Yeah, but he's got, like, this – he's got this goal of resurrecting a very young bride who he was infatuated with back in the day, and
she maybe married him and then killed herself.
Yeah,
was shot. Now her scenes are all shot like a Whitesnake video.
Yes,
she's by herself with this like ethereal light and her flowing blonde locks of hair. It was very.
If you look at the cover or the poster of Spookies, that is the bride who is getting her dress torn asunder. But. The goal is, from what I've gathered, the rules are this guy, the sorcerer, resurrects or conjures these creatures and beings to scare and kill our dysfunctional family. And the more people they kill, the more power he's given to resurrect her.
Like chess pieces on a table.
And then halfway through the movie, she wakes up and she's like, fuck, I don't want to be married to you, and I don't want to be back in the world of the living. Put me back, you know?
But it's very weird. In order to achieve this goal, he resurrects literally like a playing card deck
a menagerie of monsters. Yeah.
One thing I read,
like, the
made
vampires
sense,
are over here, the zombies, the werecat pirate.
But the first woman, because they pull out the Ouija board, right? And she, the first woman, turns into basically an Evil Dead kind of character.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And then listening to the commentary, he just kept saying to us, "We make it Evil Dead. Make it Evil Dead." It wasn't the filmmakers at all, just this producer going, "Make it more like Evil Dead." But it has every, I think why I fall in love with this weird-ass movie is just because every 5 minutes you get a different kind of creature, and some of them are really well done.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Not the flatulence creatures.
So that's the weirdest part of it for me.
Yeah, that's a sound designer going, "Hey, let's just throw in some."
Yeah, so the zombies fart.
They're called muckmen.
When they go into the cellar, the wine cellar, and these things come out, they actually kind of look cool, but they're farting the whole time. And I had to stop and text Ryan. I was like, "Are there farting monsters in this movie?"
Yep.
And he's like, "Yes, there are."
Oh, yeah. And you, the reason you can tell it wasn't done in the shooting is because the characters aren't reacting to farts.
No.
I mean, somebody in post
just went,
"Hey, let's throw some farts on this."
Yeah,
But the creatures, the designs are, you've got like an 18-year-old Gabe Bartalis doing the design. Jennifer Aspinall is in there.
I love Jen Aspinall.
Our original killer POV guest way back, the producer of Street Trash. He's on it.
Frumke.
Roy Frumke. Your old teacher.
Yeah.
He's one of the kind of guys. So it's all these people who had just been part of Street Trash. I'm not sure on the timeline there.
Right.
So you see that in kind of the effects.
Yeah. No, there's definitely ingenuity. What I love about Spookies, my takeaway from Spookies is it's one of those kitchen sink films where – fuck the story, because like you said, I would never been able to tell what was the additional shooting, what was the added subplot, because it just, like,
on first go it would be hard.
I'm guessing it was the bride stuff.
The guy,
but also the little
the
boy
guy
at
the and
start.
The bride were the always by himself.
Okay, so we can't forget the little boy at the start of the movie. It was like this little like backpack wearing, baseball cap wearing kid who is there to pour one out for a fallen brother, and then he comes across this sorcerer, and then the sorcerer sicks the werecat on him.
Yeah,
and the
pirate werecat.
Were pirate. And it's one of those weird, like, kind of tangents that you're like, okay, am I going to follow this kid? Oh no,
yeah,
no, not at all. But if you strip away the bride stuff, you've got the flimsiest fucking story to an already flimsy story, because it would just be about people showing up at the house and being attacked by monsters. That would be it.
FYI, think about how that kid's demise is like a movie from last year, Doctor Sleep.
Very
similar. Oh. Kind of brutal, being buried.
That kid gets it.
So, I mean, it is weird. Like, I do think that stuff, I think I could see, so the people who made this film who are on the DVDs, you don't get to hear from the reshoot people.
Yeah.
The producer's dead. They just go all out to savage them.
Oh, yeah.
But it's like
maybe that's why it's coming out now, finally.
But there's a part of me watching it go, like, I think the stuff, the woman was the other director who came on, and she was the editor in the end. It's like, I think it's pretty fun. Like, I think the stuff she did is also pretty good. So they're all kind of throwing it under the bus, but I'm like, guys, your stuff didn't make much sense either.
Yeah.
But there's a character, the one creature with the cyst.
The death creature with the glowing heart.
Yeah, that was so fun, a really cool creature.
And I love the Spider Woman.
Yeah.
Oh, the Spider Woman was my fave.
That
the
was
side
super cool.
Yeah.
No, I mean, like, that's the thing I love about it is like they just threw everything at the wall and they were just like, just keep it.
Yeah, well, you know what? I think it's this movie falls – this is not Shockwaves approved, I don't think.
I don't think I could in good
But if I can double approve something, then I can omit one of you and it gets its approval.
But what I think it is it's more of an ideal – it's the perfect midnight movie, the sort of weird WTF thing you watch then. It's a perfect party movie.
Yes.
This is the sort of movie to have in the background if you're having friends over, because they'll look up every couple of minutes and be like, wait, what the fuck are we watching?
No, and
I don't get this.
That is how I would recommend watching this, because I watched it by myself when I was home alone.
Same.
And I told Ryan at the screening last night that there were moments where I was like drifting.
Yeah.
And I was like, I really have laundry to do. Oh, Spookies. Yeah, yeah. Spookies. But I have a feeling that if I had watched this with a crowd, it would have been the best thing I'd seen
like
all
year.
Like a
Tammy and the T-Rex or something.
Yeah, or like Death Spa. Yeah, like Death Spa. I remember watching that by myself as opposed to with a crowd. It's completely different screenings.
Yeah. I think it's a really, because I start right before Halloween on YouTube. I think it's a great like Halloween movie to pull out because there's so many creatures, so many monsters. Yeah. It's like a good one to just kind of set
agree.
The mood.
You know? I agree. Overall, it is a party movie. I don't know if I'm going to pull it out. It's not one of those bad movies that I'll pull out and just sit down and watch and amuse myself with. Not like something like the gem that is Mausoleum. But yes.
There's a fight scene in this longer than the They Live sequence. And it makes no sense. You don't even know why the characters are fighting. You're like, why are you guys fighting when everything else is happening around you?
Yeah, yeah.
But the casting, and so the funny thing, so I'm asking, like, why do these characters know each other? And then I'm watching the extra features, and it's got the actors, and they're like, we didn't have a clue how our characters even knew each other. It's like 30 years later, there's still one. And I'm like, that's okay. No one wrote that.
Yeah, the Vinegar Syndrome disc has, I've only taken a look at the first disc, which has the Alamo Draft House introduction. When they had a Spookies screening recently,
oh,
and
wow.
It was like,
yeah, I saw that.
I think it was one of the writers,
the weird puppet guy,
Puppet guy, and then the guy who had like the Spookies VHS on the bat in the back, and he grabs it and he just starts talking shit about the producers.
But it's the other disc that has like a two-hour documentary.
There's a feature-length documentary about Spookies on there.
But I do think this will be one of those few films where you will get that great story. I just wish I would have loved to have heard more about the people who aren't. Talking about
well, you haven't gone through everything yet, so maybe
it's in there.
And just to clarify, we had picked this because this was a Black Friday release from Vinegar Syndrome.
We all bought it.
That we all got, but by the time we posted about this, it was far sold out.
Yeah.
So I checked with Vinegar Syndrome, so the one that sold out is their initial one that has like the fancy slipcase. There will be a standard disc coming out later this month.
Okay,
so just keep following them on Facebook or Twitter, and they'll post links to the standard edition.
Wait, am I the only one giving this an approval? That's terrible. Wait, come on. Ryan, you're on board, right?
I don't think I can. I feel dirty about it,
Elric. I love this movie.
Elric, I thought about this for the last week. I was like, I'm on the fence.
He was really considering, man.
No, I seriously was because when we're on this show, we got to take a hard line. We got to, is it approved or not? And you know what? I'm going to go with approved.
Oh,
yes.
Dude, I'm going to go with approved. Don't make me dissenting opinion.
No. Can we go with a new sticker that's like Shockwave's party movie?
I like that.
No, you know what I like? Shockwave Semi. Did you get a Shockwave Semi? I did.
Semi hard
Spookies is our first Semi.
You know what? We should just get stickers of our faces. It'll be half me and half
who
you.
Who liked it? Yeah.
I mean, look, because I feel like it is one of those 80s movies that has you know, there was definitely something at its core that was good intentioned.
Yeah.
You know, like there was a good intentioned movie here, regardless of whether the producers got involved or not. Like I love, as I said, the Menagerie of Monsters. I love that there's just something so like kind of let's make it up as we go along with the bride stuff. Yeah. I mean, like the bride chase scene.
It's very Me Too. It's very she's on the run. There's just so much to tap into now.
Right.
Come on. I actually did worry about her because there's just all these random people grabbing at her. And I was like, this is getting kind of gross.
Well,
guys.
I was like, oh, the cover is actually coming to life. Mm-hmm. The key art's coming to life now. But the Spookies.
I like Spookies a lot.
Shockwave's party approved?
Yeah.
Whatever. Okay. Anyways.
Thank you.
So you know we should do the Shockwave slumber party.
The slummy party. Yeah, slumber party movie. I like that.
Although I do like a slummy party too.
Slumming party.
Well, it gave me a semi, so we move on. Shockwave semi.
Well, Ryan and I went to the movies.
Yeah.
And saw a Shockwave's party movie, which I would consider.
Oh, dude, this movie is a fucking gem. This gets a gold star.
I was so jealous that you guys were at this one.
Yeah.
People got to pay attention to
this. I know.
You got to listen to the calendar show, man.
I was literally sitting in a meeting watching Instagram going, those fuckers. Oh, my God.
Yeah, we were there to see 1985's Lamberto Bava gem, Demons.
And is there anything better in life than seeing a movie theater in a movie theater? That's the best.
Oh,
right?
Well, no.
What was great was, you know, I was telling Phil Blankenship on our way in, the last time I saw it was at a midnight screening where I felt completely delirious, and I was equally delirious at 2 p.m. because this is a matinee show. Yeah. It played mid-afternoon. Yeah. There was something fun about coming out into the sun after that movie.
And knowing everything is all right and the world is not a post-apocalyptic demonic landscape.
Well, that was 2 days later. But
well done. Well done, sir.
Yes, that's good.
But for anyone who hasn't seen it, I guess, what is this about? It's basically...
You've got Michele Soavi walking around the streets of... Where are they?
Italy?
Are they in Italy?
Yeah. I think it is.
In Italy or Rome. And
the cool
half face mask, and he's passing out tickets to a free movie at Metropole, and it's about a bunch of teenagers who go to the movie theater to watch this spooky movie, which is also about demons.
Yeah.
And suddenly
I hope it's not a horror movie.
And suddenly there's an outbreak of demon possession. And they, when the audience tries to scramble their way out of this and away from this threat, they discover that the theater has been all boarded up and now they're trapped inside. And what I like about this movie is that it is almost demonic possession by way of like virus.
Yeah.
You know, you get it takes vampiric and zombie tropes. So if you get scratched, if you get bit, you come back as a demon. And in some way, in more extreme cases, like there's a girl in it that where a demon literally comes out of her back.
Yeah.
And then, yeah. And it becomes a movie, a tale of survival. It's a internal siege movie. Rather than the demons being on the outside, they're actually inside and nobody can get out. Mm. And it's just such a blast. Mm-hmm. The movie, you got motorcycle racing, you've got a pimp in his ladies of the evening.
Yeah. That's a friend of mine.
This is one of those movies that I still look back on and I'm like, God, there's so many iconic shots in this. Like, yeah, it's so well made. Like, the specifically the one that I love is the backlit zombies crawling
with their
over
eyes
the theater
glow.
With the
beautiful.
There's
so few films that move like this. Like when Inside's at its best, or High Tension, those kind of movies, when they're at full force, that's how Demons is the whole movie. That's what I love about it, you know.
It's a fun movie, and it just keeps it's a movie of escalation, so things just keep getting heightened and heightened, and before you know it, there's a helicopter crashing through the ceiling.
Oh yeah.
And then our heroes ultimately find salvation, or you know, do they? But it's a blast, and it made me actually want to run home and watch Demons 2, but I got sidelined by some other stuff.
Maybe, same here. Demons.
I love Demons 2, but I've talked about the show. Yeah. That's like my Kinder trauma. I probably watched that at a slumber party. I think it was fourth grade, and the demon coming out of the television like fucked my shit up for life.
Yeah.
I love it.
It's so much fun. And they do what they kind of did in Return of the Living Dead and Return of the Living Dead Part 2, which is like they took characters who died in the first one and just recast them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
it's basically like a redo.
It's a little bit of a redo in an apartment complex.
The movie that the end of Demons promises, though.
Yeah.
You know, like
TV
like,
show, brother. Let's do it.
I want to see like demons treated as zombies or whatever.
You know, is so, and this is just speaking from kind of like a hang around AFM and the markets for a while. We do not see demons like that on screen anymore. And it's really hard. Like anytime that I've even talked to people about them, it's very much like, well, what about angels? And I'm like, there are no angels. They're just demons. Yeah. They're not zombies. No, they're demons. Yeah. And we just don't have that kind of character existing in contemporary horror. I miss it. It's kind of the Evil Dead thing.
Yeah. And I think if there was like a spiritual successor to that, it would be Wreck.
Yeah, because you're right. Because it blends the supernatural with the zombie virus trope, and the fact that spread, kind of like a systemic spread, but that there is something kind of a supernatural element to it.
Yeah.
But the demons in Demons, the first one, don't they discover some sort of bones or something that helps trigger this? Or is that demon?
No, in Demons,
they wear the mask.
One of the pimps' ladies gets a scratch on her face because she's wearing a promotional mask that's actually featured in the movie. So in the movie, this girl finds the silver demon mask, and she puts the guy puts it on his face, gets the scratch, and then she's like, oh, I did the same thing and my face is scratched. Mm-hmm. And then shit starts to escalate from there.
What's with the blind dude sitting in the back row that's got
with the lady who's the woman who's
his
like,
caretaker that just randomly leaves him to go make out with some dude? Like, wait, what's going on back there?
And then if you want the serious version, you get the church is kind of like if it would have been
unofficial.
Yeah. It would have been, and it's a good movie. I like
the church. Yeah, it's a much slower pace than Demons, but still good.
But the demons still look like the demons, which is cool.
What I like in the second one is the pimp is now a fitness instructor.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And then
that's
he's
totally
like
80s.
He becomes like a real hero where he's like, we gotta help these people. They need our help. And they start boarding up the doors in the parking garage, and it's amazing. I love it.
Me and Becca. So you guys
started. Oh, you guys want a double date too?
Well, the funny thing is, we went a couple days later to where, as she just said, to see the Miyazaki film, and they mentioned that you guys, they're like, oh, it's a Shockwaves weekend.
Yeah, they were like, Shockwaves has been here all weekend.
Just not
all
together.
Not all together. But we actually went and saw a brand new time travel movie called The Grudge by Nicholas Pesky.
Wow.
It's basically a time travel movie, wouldn't you say, Becca? Time jump?
I think that it It had five different timelines.
In the first 5 minutes, I think.
Going throughout.
Yeah. It's a little dislocating. But this is Nicholas Pesky. And I always want to start with a positive. The positive is he's made one of the best films, one of the films I liked most this year, being Piercing.
I went home and rewatched Piercing.
Yeah, no, I'm a huge fan. It's going to be on my other list. Eyes of My Mother is a really atmospheric film. This film, I can see Eyes of My Mother coming into this movie in terms of his style, in terms of his aesthetic. But what doesn't work about this Grudge for me at all and just really just takes you out very quickly is the timeline. And it's just like the composition of the script in a sense. Like if that's the script we're watching, unless this is a re-edit. Like if this could have been chronological storylines because you've got multiple stories.
Yeah.
But because it keeps switching in time, you have no time to care like about any group of people. And you're suddenly getting jump scares with some really cool looking imagery.
Yeah, the jump scares. There were certain jump scares that I was like, okay, that was successful. But they didn't do anything. That was my biggest complaint.
Yeah, they jumped out, but they never really came.
There was no repercussions for anything. It was just, oh, now you've got it. And even that meant nothing in it. It was just, okay, now you're crazy. Now you're crazy. What I liked that it was attempting was that it was really trying to show, second time tonight I've used this word, the systemicness of the curse of how, they were really trying to look at 10 to 15 years surrounding just this one house and how it had affected everyone who had kind of moved in, moved out, come into the house. Certain people became obsessed with it. And Lynn Shay gave like a hell of a performance in it.
Well, it's got really good actors. That's the other thing. Mandy from the actress.
Andrea Riseborough, who has become like this kind of cult figure in the horror world, I feel like. She's like the go-to, if you need her to be a woman pushed to the limits, go to Andrea Riseborough. Because she's in Brandon Cronenberg's movie.
And that she wears Black really Mirror great episode. Sweaters in this one. But, a lot of sweaters.
But she's so interesting. But like you don't really – like. I think if this movie had just opened – just been a little more traditional, which is hard for me to get those words out because I like weird shit. If it just kind of started with her and stayed with her for a while, I could have really gotten into her character. And then I would say like every time you open a case file – cut to that storyline, but instead you're getting these stories before you even really get to know anyone.
They pulp fictioned the plot is how I could best put it, where they rearranged it chronologically to give you what I think was four or five different stories. And then you would slowly realize that they were kind of related to each other.
But that's what Ju-on and Grudge, they've always adopted for better or for worse and for, you know, successfully or unsuccessfully. I mean, was this a little bit more disjointed than the others?
I think it was more jumps. And also, I know it's tough, and I'm sure these are studio notes, right? But like when you bring up the date, like 1959, 1989, whatever it is, it's like at a certain point you don't really need that anymore. Like you're just going with the characters, but they keep doing it. So it's very...
And plus, I was struggling because even though that they were throwing these dates up, literally like every 10 minutes, it would shift dates.
Yeah.
But sometimes even less than that. Like you would see a scene, like a 30-second scene, and then it would throw you back in time or forward. But at the same time, for aesthetical purposes and kind of production value, they were using a lot of really stylized production value. So it would be like 1991, and then you'd see this guy in a 70s jacket pull up in a 60s car.
Yeah.
And so it was just – it was a little –
well, it's
kind
weird
of confusing
when the aesthetic, like usually I'm really drawn because it kind of reminds, he has an aesthetic that reminds me of like Blackcoat's Daughter or Eyes of, he's still bringing that aesthetic to it.
Yeah.
But in this, maybe it's because it's not slow enough. Like the things he does well seems to be he slows time down.
We talked about how
slow time
the closing credits, he holds a shot for probably 2 minutes. It was my favorite part of the movie.
Yeah, it's the creepiest part of the movie. Yeah, I think things are just moving too fast for his style because he has these very stylized frames. But when you don't get time in them, it feels kind of redundant. And it's a tough one. I do think it's on a structural level a mess, honestly. Mm-hmm. But I do think there's a lot of interesting stuff. There's images in there, and I know some of them have been in Ju-on, but like the hand coming out of the hair in the shower is a great horror image. Mm-hmm. Just looks great. It's interesting. A couple of the creatures look really good, but it just doesn't work.
But what this did get me to do is as soon as we saw it, I went home that night and I was like, I want to rewatch Piercing. And I rewatched Piercing as soon as I got home that night. And God, that's a great film.
Yeah.
It's just
it's not on my horror list because I don't see it as a horror film.
Yeah. I don't know. I do. Yeah, like rewatching it, I mean, it's literally about a serial killer. And then, it goes more than that.
Well, yeah, okay.
I call it the horror.
Oh, that's revealed in the first 10 minutes. That's not a spoiler.
No, he's a guy trying.
He disagrees with you that he's a serial killer.
I think it's the horror take on like the Phantom Thread.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
No, I wouldn't have a problem making someone's horror list. I'm just saying it wouldn't
make
mine.
I've never heard that before.
Yeah. I like it though. But no, he's good. And I still, you know, again, I don't care. The studio misfires from interesting directors. Hopefully he'll get to make another thing that, you know.
I'm sure he will.
Yeah.
I'm waiting to hear the stories about this one, though, to know if this was the film that he got to make from start to finish, or are we going to hear a year from now all those stories behind the scenes? I'm curious.
Yeah, like I'm intrigued to see like how the mythos was folded in.
Yeah.
And you know, was that, did he want to kind of blow up the world, or was it like a studio note that you have to rely so heavily on everything that came before? So yeah, I'm interested.
But that was The Grudge.
The stories.
Stone Theaters, I believe.
Yes.
Yeah. I saw Smoke and Mirrors. The story of Tom Savini, the documentary that's on Shudder. I think it is definitely worth a look just because of just to see the level of openness Tom Savini went to talk about his story and talk about his personal life. And he really goes deep. I mean, the documentary itself has I noticed this on Letterboxd. There was a lot of fire being leveled at it for being technically challenging, and I completely agree. I mean, like, it feels like a very indie doc, and I kind of wish that maybe Shudder or someone could have stepped up to help clean up sound levels and all that kind of business, but it wears its heart on its sleeve, and Tom made himself readily available for interviews, and those who are his contemporaries and colleagues and family members are all involved, including his daughter and, you know, guys like Greg Nicotero and, you know, filmmakers like Danny McBride, who was caught on a red carpet talking about Tom Savini. But, you know, at first I was kind of like, okay, we're going to get like a recap of his career, stories I've already heard, stories from Tazo, stories from Friday the 13th, yada, yada, yada. And then it wasn't until about halfway through when Tom started opening up about, so this is why I kind of stepped back from the industry, because I was dealing with my wife and dealing and becoming a dad. That's when, maybe it's just because I'm a father now myself, that's when I started getting even more interested and started really, really paying attention. Because he was like, yeah, I stepped back. I had to take care of my daughter. And then he starts talking about, you know, why he's kind of eased back from the business in general today, and he's become more of a teacher. And he said something that kind of I rewound because I couldn't believe I heard it, but he was like, yeah, my hands aren't what they used to be. And I thought that was incredibly open and honest and very revealing. I was like, wow, you don't hear that much, especially from some of our, you know, the horror icons who are getting up there and near. So I commend him for, you know, participating in that. But it's a really good doc. It moves really fast. It, you know, hits all the beats that you want to hit.
Much about the Vietnam stuff. That's the part that always fascinates
me. Always. Yeah, yeah. I feel like the Vietnam stuff is like one of those things that I feel like I know like the back of my hand, but he definitely goes into it. So check it out. It's a great documentary on Savini, and there's a book as well that just came out that I want to check out and see if it covers any other bases that haven't been covered in the doc. So check it out. Smoke and Mirrors. It's on Shudder. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. So it was New Year's Eve where I'm sitting there watching Terror Train and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, getting ready for 2020.
Yep.
And right before, a couple hours before midnight, Ronin Flicks, who sells all of these Scorpion releasing titles, was like, guess what? Boom, for sale now, Dario Argento's Phantom of the Opera and The Card Player Blu-ray.
Oh, shit.
So I immediately snapped them both up. Yeah. It was so funny because Matt Serafini, who's on the show, he's like, well, it's 15 minutes into the new year and I've already bought two Blu-rays.
Nice.
It's like without any hesitation. And and so I picked these both up. You know, this is latter-day Argento.
Yeah.
So people, of course, have mixed feelings about it. But there's something about, especially for him, for me, that – I obsessively want to own his entire filmography and go through it all. And so I don't really remember seeing either of these films. I went with The Card Player because I was like, this is the one I don't remember at all. And The Card Player is actually a pretty fascinating movie. It's weird because it's 2004 and I think it was a theatrical film in Italy, and yet It feels kind of TV-esque, and I don't mean to.
I think that was geared, wasn't it?
Maybe it was.
Do you like Hitchcock was shot for TV? I don't know. I don't think this one was.
And really? That's why, because yeah. It was that era of Do You Like Hitchcock? And but anyway, it's basically a very of its time thriller with older computer graphics and stuff. Somebody that's threatening the police to a card game. He's kidnapping women. And it's like, look, I'm gonna kill this woman unless you play me at poker, or whatever. So it's like this online poker thing. So it's a little silly in that regard, only because it's totally 2004 poker graphics on the internet, and people. It's kind of fun seeing people try to investigate people on the internet, and it takes very long to trace where it is. And it's like, we think he's in Rome. No, he's not. It's bouncing somewhere else, whatever. But all that aside, because most of Argento, even his earliest stuff, is kind of far fetched in that way. It's got some good Argento stuff to it.
I think this and Sleepless are the last two kind of watchable ones for me. Like Sleepless, I quite like, having rewatched that this year. And I haven't seen Card Player for a long time, but it's shot by that appreciation
exactly
post a couple days ago.
Exactly what I was going to bring up.
Yeah, Benoit Debye, who shot Irreversible and Enter the Void and Spring Breakers.
There's a new interview with Dario Argento on here, which I found really fascinating. Cool. The first revelation was that Asia was supposed to be the lead, and I think she was doing a movie here in America. Mm. And he's like, "Well, I have one shot to make it, so I'm going to make it." And that's where he got. I think it's Stephanie Rocco took the lead over her. But his older daughter, Fiora Argento, plays one of the kidnap victims, and she's actually really good. I didn't realize it was another Argento. I was like, oh yeah.
I think she dies in a lot of his movies, just very briefly.
Well, no. So she was she's the girlfriend in Demons, that one of the girlfriends in Demons as well.
Oh,
I didn't realize that was Argento's oldest daughter, and I think she just did a few of the early ones, whatever the case is. But Dario is actually really candid on this Blu-ray, being like, you know what? I look at her in this movie, and she was damn good, and I probably should have used her more. Not over Asia, but like I feel like he worked with Fiora, and for whatever reason, maybe she wasn't like into the film industry. Mm-hmm. I think she became a fashion designer. I'm not 100% sure. But I think Asia was more like, as a child, like just really took to the filmmaking aspect of it more. So anyway, I think it was at right after Irreversible, through Gaspar Noé, he met the cinematographer.
Oh, interesting.
He was just like asking, like, oh, I need somebody to help me shoot this movie. And he's like, you should see my latest film. And
yeah, so if
like,
you saw Climax this year, it's the same DP as Climax.
Yeah, Climax.
But I mean, it's obviously – there's just a couple bits I remember looking really good, but not necessarily the whole movie. Like I remember – I don't know, something not sparkling.
And that's what I mean about the TV thing. It's like he kind of – there's – it's pretty straightforward. It's a very straightforward procedural, the way it's shot, as opposed to his like overusage of lights and that kind of stuff. So, but it's pretty good. It's pretty darn good.
I honestly have not seen it since when it came out, 2004. I honestly haven't seen it since then, but I remember it being the lesser of the contemporary Argento evils.
Yeah.
But I think it was just because I got swept up in the procedural of it all while I kept dipping its toe into things that tickled me about opera, which I love, which was just top three for me. And I was like, okay, good. He's trying to balance, newer audiences and their expectations and what horror was doing then, while also going, you know what, I'm going to do my old school shit too.
It's surprisingly pretty tame too. Yeah. Like it's not nearly as gory as his previous
movies. Did Sleepless get a re-release?
Because
I saw it last year, but it wasn't on Blu-ray.
I thought it was going to be announced with this one, so I think it's coming.
Because that's another one I would recommend people check out as well. Like Max von Sydow is good, and it's actually a good standard thriller. It's just they're not up to the opera. They don't have the musicality, if you know what I mean. Like the way the camera moves, the way that the music goes. But they don't have that anymore.
There's something a little bit tired about the actual filmmaking itself.
Exactly. Yeah. They're more like Tenebrae if you take out that magic of Tenebrae, that part of the Tenebrae, But they're watchable thrillers.
It's interesting. I would recommend revisiting The Card Player, and hopefully Sleepless will come out soon. And I also picked up Phantom of the Opera, which I do remember not liking at all.
Yeah, I don't really remember that.
But I want to revisit it, and also the fact that Julian Sand was on not too long ago. So get to see him in that movie again.
Oh,
so
yeah. Phantom of the Opera.
Do you remember it well?
I remember the Phantom running through a tunnel with rats and a minion. Okay. And that was it. And I just remember howling about it, just laughing my ass off.
And well, that says Robert Englund, right?
No.
That's Toby.
That's the other one entirely.
Wait, so who's in this one? Julian Sands? Oh, that's right.
And Ozzy.
That's right. We talked about this. Yeah. Okay.
I'm sad. I missed this. I actually like this movie.
We weren't talking about it. We haven't watched it.
We're getting there.
I enjoyed this.
That'll be a future.
Maybe we should just do a Phantom of the Opera episode.
Hey.
Look as many as we can.
I actually like the Robert Englund one as well.
I do too. I have a soft spot for that. No, come on, Ryan.
I kind of do. I kind of do. I own it, so it's still there.
Which one had the girl from The Stepfather?
That's Robert Englund.
That is Robert Englund. Yeah. Okay, yeah.
Joel Sholin, yeah.
Dwight Little, director of Halloween 4.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Oh, yep, there you go.
Well, I have, just because I have to get them in now or else they're not going to be timely. So over the break, I decided to watch, which I had not seen before, Silent Night, Deadly Night 4 and 5.
Oh, boy.
So you're so Christmas. I know. I'm so like last month, but I watched them for Christmas, and this is our first show back. So, yeah.
So that is the Initiation and the Toymaker. Yeah, I like the Toymaker.
So I liked the Initiation.
You willingly watched these.
I totally willingly watched
Brian Yuzna.
So I really enjoyed Initiation.
Really?
Which I know everyone said that. I said, like, it was super fucking fun, guys. Everyone's like, really? So it's got a lot of bug action. It was really gory. It was Screaming Mad George doing the effects.
He did five.
I don't know.
This is the witch one, right?
This is the witch one.
My memory is there was nothing to do with Christmas at all in that film. That was my problem with that film.
It was. And it's Christmas and I'm getting these weird like cult messages and then like this weird bug cockroach. It's a lot of like metamorphosis. Uh-huh. It is Yuzna being the most Yuzna I can think of him. It's very gooey.
That's a good thing.
I couldn't tell you what the plot was. It had nothing to do with Christmas. There was something about a witch cult that she was being initiated into and there was some, she was giving birth. There was like this crazy like extra-ish birth scene with a bug. And so that just kind of hit all my, I don't know what the hell's
and
going
Clint
on.
Howard?
But
is Clint Howard in that one?
Clint Howard's in, he's in both of them, but he is, he plays different characters. Or it might be the same character, I'm not sure. But he has different personas in both
of them. But Mickey Rooney, who is in part five. And
Mickey
he's fantastic.
Rooney. So I post up, I'm watching part five, and the amount of people who are like, oh, that's a damn good movie, was shocking. I don't know.
It's really fun. I think it might be my favorite of all of them, besides obviously the first, and then the second's more for crazy value. But
so this was not Yuzna directed. That one is Yuzna produced and Screaming Mad George.
This is directed by Marty Kitrosser, who is the only reason it's an itch. He wrote Friday 13th Part 2 and 3, but he has been Quentin Tarantino's first assistant director for every single movie. And he's been – so his career has been basically – so he's actually my dream guest for Pure Cinema because like that's just fascinating in its own right, even though he made this movie. I don't think he directed anything else after this.
No, I looked it up. And he had been involved with a couple of other horror films as a writer. But yeah, then he went on to do Quentin stuff. Mm. And part five definitely leans a lot more in Christmas where it's this guy who's making these kind of messed up toys. And Clint
Howard – they're designed by Scream Mad George. Those toys. Yeah.
And Clint Howard's in it and he's got this weird son who is trying to hand out the toys and it's equally gooey. It still feels super used. Now it uses a lot of the cult mythos set up in part four in different ways. So there's no like through storylines. I could not write a Bible on these movies, but yeah, it was still
How about
there.
At the end of this year, we'll go and we'll all rank the whole series. That'll be our Christmas reading.
You know what?
Everyone's
I'm
so
going to counter
that
with a Halloween homework assignment, which is we go through all the Amityville horror movies.
It's all about
if you're
time.
You're going to put that shit on me. I'm going to put that shit
on
you.
That's like how many films is that? 20?
That's 17. A lot of
it's more because they keep.
Both just sound excruciating.
You know what I say to that challenge? It's about time. Which Amityville is that?
What
four
was
or five?
That, I think that was
four, I think.
Five?
Amityville five.
No,
about,
it was after. There's a doll. There's one about a lamp. I remember the haunted. Yeah.
I'm into it.
But anyway, so Silent Night, Deadly Night.
Becca, I commend your patience.
Thank you. Thank you. Yes.
See anything else?
Take a lot of dedication.
Anything else?
I had one other. I'm curious if any of you saw the new Rabbit. Anyone see the new Rabbit?
The what?
The Shushkas.
The Shushkas.
Oh, Rabbit.
Rabbit.
Oh, I think you said Rabbit.
Oh, I didn't. What do I sound like, Australian tea or something? Yeah, no. It's you know, the Suska's new film is a remake, I guess, of Rabbit. It's you know, very different. To be honest, I think if it had been called American Mary 2, I might have gone down better, because it actually feels like a lot of it felt like American Mary 2. A lot of it's about plastic surgery, so that's obviously in line, and facial reconstruction, which is very much in line with the first film, American Mary rather. The parts that are actually coming from Rabbit are the things that work least for me. It feels like it's almost an afterthought to have, you know, society breaking down and a virus spreading. It literally feels like it's kind of pigeonholed at the end of this movie to catch you up. But so
that sounds more Shivers.
It does a bit. Yeah, it's like, well, but you know, at the end of Rabbit, you have all the whole society's breaking down, and in this, it's just kind of a throwaway. But it's the weird thing is, it kind of feels like it's taking Neon Demon, but you know, the fashion industry. Which Neon Demon, that part I think Neon Demon does really well. It's a woman trying to break through into fashion in this film, and then she gets horribly disfigured and goes to a clinic where they're going to – kind of like the clinic in Rabbit, the original Rabbit. But in this one, it's more about giving her this kind of serum, which is probably some sort of virus or blood, that her face will – suddenly she looks beautiful, and suddenly her art is popping when she comes back. And then it's just – it feels like a lot of different maybe movies wrestling with themselves, maybe because it's a remake and you're trying to balance your original vision, which is, you know, I think what they showed in American Mary, I think, which is very original, but mixed with something that I feel like maybe they're worried about doing it justice. And for me, that's where it kind of broke down a little bit. There's some visuals that are very interesting, and like it had a really great creature at the end that I wasn't expecting. So if you've only seen Cronenberg's in your, because I got to be honest, I don't mind somebody remaking that. It's probably, to me, one of my least favorite Cronenberg films, right. Because it's one I'm always excited because it sounds cool. It's about sexually transmitted creature, and then you watch it and it just doesn't have the same kind of rhythm or focus of his other films. But they do something quite different with it, and I think where it goes is radically different. It didn't necessarily work for me, but in a way that is kind of good because it's not a straight remake, and I think somebody could watch it and go, oh, I love this movie. It's just, you know, it's going to come down to your taste, you know. So anyway, different thing. I don't know if they should – I think they should keep making their original stuff personally and not – because I had heard they were going to do another Cronenberg remake.
Yeah,
and I'm like, no,
they've
don't do
got
that.
Another one coming, yeah. Shivers. Yeah, I don't even
just
remember
leave those movies
was.
Exist. I think I'd like to see what they would do on their own. Okay. So that's still on the, you know, Amazon. You have to pay for it, but it's out there.
Cool.
Excellent.
Awesome.
Okay, guys. Well, we're going to take a break, hear a word from our sponsor, and we are going to come back with the Boulay Brothers.
Fright Rags is ringing in the new year with an all-new collection for Rob Zombie's House of 1,000 Corpses, featuring new t-shirts and enamel pins, plus reprints of classic designs and socks. Officially licensed and available on Tuesday, January 14th. Also stay tuned Thursday, January 16th for a special four-day pre-order event featuring a brand new t-shirt celebrating horror icon John Carpenter's birthday. Available exclusively at fright-rags.com. Shockwave's listeners get 10% off their first order using SHOCK2020 at checkout. You will not want to miss that four-day pre-order of the John Carpenter t-shirt. I don't know if you guys have seen it yet, but it's John Carpenter in all his glory, surrounded by all his icons, and it is one hell of a way to celebrate the Master of Horror's birthday.
Your homepage for horror is here. Fangoria.com is now live and brimming with the digital horror content that you crave. Fangoria.com is your first destination for all the horror news of the day, featuring a constant curation of the Fango team's favorite links from across the internet. They're taking the time to aggregate the most important news in horror in one space to save you the time and sanity. You'll also find long-form pieces, deep dives, and daily thoughts from the biggest names in horror, as well as exclusive access to the Fangoria Vault. Right now, all current subscribers to the magazine are automatically members of Fangoria.com. And as promised, the content in the new issues will forever be print-only. If you're not a subscriber, check out the new Fangoria.com for yourself and see the horror right before your eyes. Use the promo code SHOCKWAVES for 15% off right now.
Welcome back to Shockwaves. I am and trying not to fangirl right now. I am just excited as hell to be sitting here with our guests, the Boulay Brothers, Swan Thula and Drakmordia.
Hello, darling.
Thank you so much for joining us tonight, ladies. Welcome to Shockwaves.
Thank you. We're happy to be here.
So Ryan and I, like, binged the
Becca converted me.
Okay. Becca tipped me off to it. Darren Stein.
Okay. And then you would find myself and my wife laying in bed watching your antics and me nerding out and then her getting caught up in the drag drama. And it was just so much fun. Nice. It's so much
fun. You get caught up in the deep cuts.
The deep cuts, the
references, the way you open each season, the two seasons that are currently on Netflix. I have to ask before we begin. Season 3, the opening to episode 1 with the ambulance. Mm-hmm. Halloween 4 reference?
100%.
Yes. There was just no thumbs to the forehead. Absolutely. Yeah. I was waiting for one of the clawed thumbs to get in there.
But, we don't want to do a total, you know, copy of it, but it is my favorite movie. So
nice. Great.
Well done.
Good. No, that was fantastic.
So start by telling us a little bit about the origins of the show, because after I saw 2 and 3 on Netflix, I went back and watched the YouTube season, and I loved kind of the evolution of how everything kind of progressed throughout. But start by walking us through the initial idea and how you guys were able to get that forward on YouTube.
So it really, you know, honestly, from the moment we conceived it, we wanted it to be on Netflix. That was the idea. And we've told the story a few times before where we thought, should we put a pitch together and go try to get someone to produce this? And we decided that's just not our style, because everything we've ever done, we sort of just decide to do it ourselves and then figure it out. So when you wait for people, you know, they make you wait a long time. So we're just not into that. We're very impatient. And when we come up with an idea, we want to see it happen. So instead, what we decided to do was to produce it ourselves and then let it get a fan base and then try to get someone to help us. So season 1 was sort of a pilot in a way. But it was based off of a nightclub event that we did called Dragula. And it's a club that we ran for about a year, and we knew we wanted to turn it into a reality show, and we just sort of did it. Yeah.
That's great. Now, talk about the original nightclub event. Did it have those same kind of filth, horror, and glamour tenets that go into the show now?
Very similarly. I think we got struck with like a bolt of inspiration when the idea of Dragula struck us. Because we said to ourselves, we had been promoting, we produce events. We're producers, I think, at heart. We do nightlife events. We do like theater events. We like to do huge like New Year's Eve balls and like Halloween balls and things like that. We also produce the show and our own drag careers. But we wanted to do a party that only spoke to us. All the things that we just loved, whether it be like John Waters and filth and just like super punk rock faggotry, and in a way that the city didn't offer. So we said, we don't care who's coming to this party. This is exactly what we want to do. We created it. And people were telling us that no one was going to come. It's a bad idea. This is going to be like a money sink. And there was just a line around the corner from night one. And it really had like this – immediately you could feel the pulse and the energy of like, this is really tapping into something. And people were just wild with it.
And I'm sorry, was this here in town or
– It was in Los Angeles, but we did it in San Francisco and New York and Austin as
That's
well.
Cool. Yeah. And everywhere we took it, it was like there was like these coven of weirdos and freaks that would come out, and just we saw their spirit in a way that I don't think they could really let it rip in other kind of nightlife outlets. So we knew right from the start, even Drac really knew right at the beginning, like even night one, she was like, this needs to be bigger. This needs to be on a platform where a lot more people can see it.
Yeah.
So how was the stage show structured versus the show that we have on Netflix now?
So it was a little different. It was a competition. So it was sort of like a pageant. So you think like a beauty pageant, but like the most horrific beauty pageant you've ever experienced in your life. We turned it into like a live experience. So, you know, you would have a lot of people there just partying, dancing, and drinking, but they were there to see the big pageant. So we would invite in usually up to like 13 people could compete, and they competed in these horrific, and we had all these exterminations just like we do on the show. Right. In the live pageant, you would have to do these crazy feats to stay in the pageant and move on to the next level and stuff like that. And it just, I don't know.
For an example, there was one pageant, which is probably one of my favorite extermination like challenges that we had in the pageant, where it was like a zombie theme or something that night. So we had like these kind of makeshift walls that you had. Your challenge, should you make it to the end, was to bust through this wall, like kind of zombie style, like rip through it. And then we had a victim stage there on stage, and you had to like rip their limb off and eat it. And it was just like all prosthetic and funny. And it was just like, when I look at the footage from that night, you have to picture like it's a nightclub, there's DJs and lights, and then all of a sudden you have patrons just getting up there in like this fucked up drag, like ripping through walls and like pulling off limbs and like eating them to see who could do it the best. It was amazing.
It was themed. So it would be like, what, you know, that one was a zombie theme, but we'd have like, we'd mix weird things like John Waters versus Susie. Yeah. So you had to come up with like a look that was inspired by those two things. It's just like really strange.
Now, on that note, I want to talk about how cutting edge this is in the drag world.
Right.
These guys don't even know this. I choreographed drag for a long time in Roanoke, Virginia. and everything that I remember from, and this is decades ago, was nightlife. It was very kind of techno music and glitz and glamour. And that was one of the things that I just loved about the show, is that it fights against that to a certain degree. So when you first came up with this, like, were you getting a lot of pushback? Was there kind of, you know, were there people in the community that were like, this isn't how it's done?
I think that for whatever reason, the way our entire career has developed sort of prepared us for this role, because by the time we started it, we really didn't give a shit what anyone thought. Mm. So it was like, if there was pushback, it just fueled us. So we really didn't care, or we just sort of were like, this is what we're doing, get into it. And people did.
Yeah.
And so there wasn't a lot of pushback, because we, you know, we've been doing so many, everything we do gets pushback. You know what I mean? We always do. Mm-hmm. Any kind of creative projects that we take on seem to be met with some sort of outrage. And that's when we know we're doing the right thing, you know? So, you know, the mainstream drag culture, I'm sure, you know, had some sort of issue with it. But it was so fresh. And even, you know, just old school drag performers related to it because they saw the spirit of it. Not that they themselves would be a monster queen, but mm-hmm. it was sort of like they just saw that it was old school drag. They saw the art form.
It was
know?
Like, it's punk, and it's sort of like political. There's like statements involved. It's not about just being beautiful or passing or whatever, which I think mainstream culture is kind of groomed to think this is the way we look at drag. This is how drag is now being like marketed and profited off of, but kind of back toward its roots. And when I was coming out, I was in New York City, I was young, and I was going out and I'm seeing like these drag performers, they were doing like the craziest, nastiest, loudest stuff. Like and it was punk and it was political and it wasn't just about being pretty or dancing to like a top 40 song.
Which is where you could almost say horror is trying to mirror itself again today. You know, horror came from a place of anger and frustration, and you were getting films like Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And I'm sorry, horror was political back then too.
Yeah.
But you know, it was. But then it kind of became popcorn fodder, and you know, you would go see gore movies and Freddy Krueger doing his thing. But now we're kind of like lurching back into what the horror roots of the 60s and 70s, you know?
Yeah, maybe that's like they're parallel. That path is like parallel as far as we're concerned, as far as like Dragula.
It makes horror today is so much more interesting, I feel like, than it was like 20 years ago because of that reason. I think, you know, for a while it did become sort of really cheesy and, you know.
Which is all great and good too. I mean,
in retrospect, you can appreciate it, right? But at the time, as a fan, I was like, this isn't speaking to me the way that old horror would, or the way that horror today does.
What
does, you know, going back a little bit, what did speak to you? You know, we all have our memories of what really hit us when we were kids, the first horror movie that maybe was Forbidden Fruit or a little too intense for us. So how far back does the love of horror go?
For me, it goes back, I mean, to as early as I can remember. We were just talking about this recently. I remember one of my first memories as a kid was sort of my grandparents lived in this really crazy house in the woods, and it was very spooky, and I didn't go over there a lot, but I spent the night there with them, and I mean, I must have been 4 or 5 maybe, and they left me in the living room on their couch in the spooky woods cabin that they lived in, and Dracula was playing. And so to this day, I'm like, why did they leave me in the living room as a 5-year-old kid watching Dracula? But I stayed up and watched Dracula, and like, I just loved it. I just loved the mood of it. And I just remember being a kid and really relating to that. So my love for horror has been from then to today.
For me, I got to say probably like, you know, somewhere in elementary school. And there are two films that kind of like stick out for me that just kind of like wedged in my brain and started like doing things. And it was The Exorcist, which really scared the shit out of me. You know, I was like, why did my parents let me watch this movie? It was like so disturbing and crazy. And religion was kind of like a big deal in my house too. And like my parents kind of had like different ways of like worshiping too. So for me, religion was always such a strange subject, and then being gay and being like in the suburbs, it just made me feel like such an alien and such an other and just such an no way to relate to anyone around me. And then The Exorcist comes in and just really, really fucked me up. And then kind of on the other side of that would be Hellraiser, because then we start delving into like just like dimensions and like the sadomasochistic like demonic beings, and it was just like those two languages met somewhere and started like kind of like training me to think in a new way.
And also, I mean, like there's no two greater films to rebel, you know, against whatever you were growing up with.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, like in my household, yeah, I mean, like there was an air of we should go to church on Sunday and we should go to church on Christmas Eve, and I was like, ah, and then you know, and it was like when I finally saw Hellraiser, it was like, no, I will not have any of this.
I shall not go then, anywhere.
Nowhere, no more. Sorry, Mom. But
I bet your dad liked Hellraiser, though.
No, my dad, the story is I remember at a convention, he had a pin that said, there are no limits. And I looked at the back of it and it said Hellraiser Incorporated or whatever. And I was like, what is that? And he goes, well, it's from this new movie from Clive Barker. And I just remembered the name from him leaving the books around the house. And then he went to go see Hellraiser opening night. And I was like, oh, can I see it? And he goes, no. You are probably never seeing that film.
God, my parents rented that for me. It's probably why I love it like I do. But yeah, my mom like rented that for me like as soon as it came out. I was probably in sixth grade. I did not understand any of it aside from Julia's a bitch, and if you take someone's skin off, you can put it on this guy. And that's about all I absorbed, but I loved it.
You stuck your fingers in the back of a man's the nape of his neck, and you suck his blood out.
Yeah, that's all you need.
And I imagine there weren't a lot of openly gay film directors at that point. I mean, when I think back through horror films, I can't think of many that were putting it like as open book as Clive is about his work and his life.
Oh, yeah. No. Yeah. And being like a child of the 80s, like the way that gay people were just kind of depicted and treated and kind of abused, like it was the blunt of a lot of jokes. Like we even went back and watched like a bunch of like queer horror, like through, like we were telling you earlier, through the 40s, like up until now. And even looking at like Sleepaway Camp, which is like really kind of groundbreaking in a huge way on so many levels. But there's some stuff there about like just like sexuality, even the way that there's like a misogyny and kind of like a weird accepted, statements about having sex with like really young underage girls, and then you know it's always like faggot, and it's like it's the brunt of the joke,
and that
always.
You could be made a certain way, like if we treat you a certain way you'll become something, which is always not what you really want to put out there
either.
But like Clive's is like so, like I remember seeing it at like I don't know 15-16, and I had never seen a horror film that personal, I think. Like, you know what I mean? It just seemed like he's laying out this thing that's so dangerous. To this day, I don't think people have really made a more personal horror. I think it still stands out as this movie that goes, this is who I am. I know who I am. Mm-hmm. I'm not in question who I am. This is it.
Sure.
Which I think is fascinating.
Nightbreed is kind of like that too, like if you think if you think about the parallel.
The monsters, yeah.
And a lot of it, some of it bleeds through in Lord of Illusions too.
Lord of Illusions.
I think there's trickles of
that one's got a lot of kind of more, I'll say, like the imagery. It just feels sexier in that regard than Hellraiser. I never perceive as sexy. It has its moments, but it's more fetishistic.
I guess it depends on what you're into.
That's true. So.
I think maybe it's all about Cronenberg's character Decker dealing with wanting
to
be
sexy.
Kinky, but he can't be kinky, so he's like trying to hide.
So he's got a gun.
He's got to put a mask on.
He's got the mask. Yeah, maybe there's a whole subtext to this one that hasn't been heard. You know, no, but it's a quote by him that when I saw the only episode I've seen so far was the Cenobite one, because they said that was a great place to dive in right before. Mm-hmm. And it reminded, seeing them all on stage, there was a quote by him in the 70s where he said he doesn't like beauty pageants, but he said if you could ever show the insides of people's bodies, that would be a beauty pageant I'd want to see. And seeing a couple of the queens come out where they're like, it looked like they're one at once melting.
Yeah.
And it was a total mess.
My favorite one from that is they were literally holding their face on hooks.
Beautiful. Victoria,
and it was out from there. Victoria. And it looked like from The Sect. Yeah. It was like, if you've seen, there's an Italian film, The Sect. And it was just this moment from it, but it was beautiful.
But it was cool to see that level of artistry, even for somebody who didn't know much about the show, diving in once and seeing how far everyone was going and pushing those reference points was really cool.
Yeah, thank you.
Can you talk a little bit about the artistry? Because that becomes even a bigger thing in the third season where we actually start to see people start doing their builds and stuff like that. And I would watch Land Insider put stuff together all day.
Yeah.
But could you talk a little bit about, because like they actually like design out the costumes and then do the full constructions and everything.
I feel like the scene that we've sort of helped foster and create is a very creative scene. I mean, these are special effects artists, you know, makeup artists, a lot of them are. And they're so creative. It's just the show is so multi-layered in that way. You know, it's not just, oh, this is a horror theme thing, or this is a reality competition or whatever. The artistry is a big part of that, that sometimes people forget. You know what I mean?
Well, we knew coming into the third season that we listened to the fans, right? So like we said, season one was like our pilot. Mm-hmm. Season two, it really got us in front of a lot of people. And we really played with a lot of like fun references. And it was maybe we leaned into a little bit more camp. But season three is when we really said, you know, we got a little more money too. It was like, this is what we are going to make this way closer to what we want it to be. And we really wanted to lean into a couple of different things. Personally, we wanted to take it into a much more definitive horror space and play up those references and even have moments that we could, okay, yes, we couldn't stick, you know, the Halloween 4 thumb, reference. Yeah, we couldn't do the thumb, but you know, just some.
It was there.
Shooting yeah. And having some like blood and effects and like chopping, you know, the episode 4 where she gets chopped and her head splits. You know, we kind of love that kind of shit. We're like, oh my God, this looks so amazing. But one of the other areas that we really wanted to explore more was the artistry. Seeing, like, adding a segment that showed the competitors in their space, in their kind of like comfort zone and wheelhouse, kind of working out those problems and showing the audience, because that was one of the things we got a lot of feedback on after season two, is we want to see the creative process. This, we also realized that this helped the audience get into the heads of the competitors.
Yes,
and kind of decide like, I really love them, or, oh, I really love them and I love the way that they think and the way that they're, you know, attacking this challenge.
It's totally true. Cause like even Hollow, I was not in as a performer, but as an artist, so much conviction.
Sure.
Like I just wanted to see everything that they did. So
exactly that.
And how do you go about the selection process of who is on the show?
Well, that, you know, we have a lot to do with that, but there's a bunch of people on our team that, you know, first of all, we hold auditions. Mm-hmm. So you have to do audition tapes and sort of fill out all this paperwork and make sure that you're not completely insane before.
Do you get insane people?
Well, what do you think?
I want stories. But
there are videos that I didn't need to see. Let's put it that way. I think sometimes
even
people,
some of the videos that you showed on the show, I was kind of like, wow, that is some dedication, because you showed the audition tapes for the third season.
Oh, yeah.
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 Some of them, yeah.
People try to shock us. They try to think like we think, and I'm like, you don't think how we think? We don't need to see that much. You know what I mean? Some of it's a little too real. Like Abora, actually, her audition tape was terrifying. Like when we watched it, I remember thinking, did this person just kidnap someone and blow their head off in the woods for real? Because like it looked real.
It looked like a snuff film in the backwoods of like Georgia, and it actually was in the backwoods of Georgia. But it was really kind of like, this looks like, you know, found footage of like some kind of weird backwood killer. And we were like, she must be on the show.
Well, one of the criteria when the siren song, the call goes out into the world, we want to see you. Are there certain criteria that come with these tapes? I mean, we want to. I mean, do you say we want to see the weirdest, strangest shit, or stick to our tenants, or what?
Like, it's like a list of things you have to do. Like, we'll ask you to answer certain questions on film. We'll ask you to go do things in the world. Like, one of the biggest things is, because we want to make sure people really are committed to this.
This is Drac's favorite part of every tape. Go for it.
We make them go out and do something in the world that is just sort of crazy or outrageous and film it.
Oh, cool.
Something that's not set up. So it has to be something that shocks the public or that could potentially get them in trouble or hurt or whatever.
Somebody dressed up as Jesus. I don't remember.
Yeah,
I just remember. That was Landon.
That was
okay,
Landon,
walking down the middle of Long Beach dressed as Jesus.
Yeah. And one of the people that were cast on season 3, Violencia, her audition tape is what got her cast on the show, because that exact challenge is what got her cast, because she went out to a Wendy's dressed as an overweight Wendy, like she went in and she was just looked crazy, and she went up to the sign and she was like, my dad is dead. And she's like, looking, and she's like ordering all this food and like crying and sitting down in the middle of the restaurant eating it. Everyone's staring at her. And she's just like, it is amazing footage.
That sounds very in line with John Waters and Divine. Like that relationship to go out and provoke and to find where the edge of things is, you know, which I appreciate that.
We want to make sure that people aren't afraid to push the envelope. Yeah. Like a lot of people can, you know, be amazing visual artists, but can you sort of, do you have the conviction to go out and perform and shock people and challenge what people think, you know? And we want to see that they can do that.
We also want to see that they're not just like, let's put on a spooky costume and get on Dracula, you know, like this kind of like, this is sort of like the fabric of like what they're made of. Like they're bona fide weirdos. And it kind of takes that, I think, to go do shit like that.
And I'm surprised too, by how many contestants there are. Like I almost said part of the joy of watching when I started season three was just watching you two introduce everybody who's on. I'm like, they're still going. There's still more people. It's amazing.
Yeah.
No, but then I love the catfights that immediately break out like moment within seconds of getting backstage. That was the drama hooked me.
Yeah. Well, like, that's what I – yeah. That's what kind of lures me in is how – is the connection by who knows who already and what kind of
family. That was fascinating.
A lot of times these people are sort of loners, you know, they grew up in small towns. They don't have a lot of friends. They just sit in their basements and create bizarre looks and things. So, you know, when you take a bunch of people like that and put them in the room, sometimes it's like a wildfire, you know? They're like, I'm not used to interacting with people and I fucking hate everybody. So they just kind of go at it, you know?
But I love, even within that though, it's true. But even within that, the kind of connections and the support group that forms and so much of it, and especially in third season with like Dahlia, it seems to be around being the outcast. And actually, I think it was Dahlia. There was one kind of speech that was given during third season that I teared up. And it was all about being the weird kid who's into weird media that no one else understands and then finally trying to find people who you can talk to and they find them there on the show. And it's so beautiful how that kind of comes out of it.
Thank you. A lot of times people will say like, you know, the two of us being like, you know, we're the dark ones or we're like the strange ones or we're the cruel ones, but we're the ones with a heart. Like we really actually care and extend ourselves to our contestants. We care. We're fans of them, first of all, because this drag world we're very plugged into. They're performers, you know, and like we're performers. So, you know, we travel all over the country and the world and it's small circles. But we really care about them when they come in, when they're on the show, and even after the show. So we try to mentor them and give them opportunity as much as we can. So when they see other freaks and connect with them, that dialogue that kind of pours forth from that, it's kind of weird to feel like supported and praised for the things that usually you get ridiculed and outcast for.
And I think some of them too got used to their interest making them special. Mm-hmm. So when they were back home and it was just them, they were the freak in town. Mm-hmm. Well, now you're not. There's 20 in the room. So what makes you special now, you know?
Yeah.
And having them, watching them deal with that and sort of what is my place in a room of other people like me for the first time, which I think is kind of interesting.
Yeah.
And the show does use, and this is just the word freak, it uses it in a positive light.
Yeah.
Like oh, yeah.
It's a good thing.
Absolutely.
And I love that element.
Well, I think, we're the same. I mean, I always feel the same as horror fans. Everyone always feels like you're there with a freak or the weird one at their school. And then doing this show for us, we connected to a lot of listeners who will then have the same stories or say they're part of a conversation. Mm-hmm. So for you guys, the audience, when you hear from people who must suddenly feel like they're not alone anymore because they're seeing these other representations, these other personalities and realizing, wow, there's this whole other world outside my little town, that must be crazy rewarding.
Yeah, it was an aspect of the show that we were not – you know, I'll speak for myself. I was not ready for.
Yeah.
So when we started touring, you know, we're about to go back to Europe in like 2 weeks. We're going through the UK and we're going to Berlin and Amsterdam and Paris. And we're bringing like 7 of the contestants from mostly from season 3. But we're bringing Victoria from season 2 because she was supposed to be with us on the last tour and wasn't able to last minute. So we're like, they want to see her. Let's bring her. So even to have the show with that kind of reach and then these, you know, kids – fans lined up to meet us and then hearing their personal stories, like the outpouring of emotion and just that, like that connection. Yeah. And I was like, oh damn, this bitch is about to make me cry right here in public. Yeah. I can't do that. You know, very unexpected,
At first I didn't know what to think of it. 'Cause that wasn't our intention. You know, I suppose just the way that we live and that we live loudly and unapologetically, that resonates with people. Yeah. Because for us, that was never something that we were rewarded for or that helped someone else or that inspired someone else. So at first I was like, what's happening? Right. I was like, I just choked this person on screen and now you're okay. Like what, where, you know, what's happening, you know? But then it started to resonate with it a little more later.
Yeah.
Well, looking at it from looking at the show overall from a macro view, is it going in the direction that you want it to, going from YouTube, and I almost kind of want to talk about the jump to Netflix, yeah, you know, sure, and what Netflix's, you know, were there parameters that Netflix had given you?
No, there wasn't. That's the great thing, knock on wood, so far, no one has tried to get in our way about anything. Everyone's been extremely supportive, whether it was Amazon, Netflix. Our original partners, we started on YouTube, and our intention is never to stay on there. You know, we really put – it was sort of like putting up a trailer on YouTube to get it to spread to as many people as possible. Yeah. But we always knew what we wanted to do with it. So the season two – the first person that picked up the show was Out TV, which is a Canadian network. Mm-hmm. And they just loved it. They were like, we want to give you a budget. We want you to make it bigger. They've been very supportive. They literally only asked us ever to change one thing in three seasons.
Wow.
Which is amazing. It was something to do with one of the performers, Bitch Pudding, did a JonBenet Ramsey thing.
Yeah.
And so there was something about JonBenet's name being used in a video or something that they wanted to get rid of. I mean, it's very reasonable, you know? But otherwise, they've been very, very supportive. So, yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, overall, in terms of the overall vision, you know, do you feel like there is more untapped potential? Do you guys want to see it get bigger?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, I think we've just kind of like, we've just sort of tasted it. You know, season two was a little, and now season three was like a nice, big, healthy bite.
It does feel like something's being fulfilled finally.
Yeah, you know? There's a feast ahead of us, though. Yeah. I mean, I feel like there's one thing that we've never had a shortage of, the two of us, which is like creative ideas. Like we've been in like this creative conversation for like 20 years. Like we're both art students. We're both highly creative people. So this just getting the go and having people like fuel us and – you know, Jack said it earlier, we don't necessarily look for affirmation from other people or like, yes, you guys can do this or you shouldn't do that or whatever. Like we go forward, we do our own thing. So the people that are giving us money have our back. Like, you know, now Netflix has like come on board and they're pushing us forward. So we feel like there's a lot of other projects that we have, like some original ideas and some like, you know, scripted ideas that we want to see come to fruition and are just like kind of starting now. But the future is like really exciting.
Yeah. And this is just the beginning. Like as far as Dragula goes, I feel like season three was a season that we started to be able to make what we wanted with it. You know what I mean? Like it was the first one that was like, this is on air. We knew it was going to be from day one.
Right.
And yeah. And on us, like you were saying, Go ahead. You know, we are working on other projects too. There's scripted some horror films and shorts that we're working on that we're excited about. We're working on a horror book. So it's sort of allowing us to move our career where we would like it to go to.
Mm-hmm.
Really quick, I want to ask about, just because this is something we never get to ask about on this show, the real element of it. The idea that you guys are having at the end of each episode, the ladies do feats, kind of like you're throwing them out of planes or they're getting tattoos, not just ladies. There's kings on the show as well.
Yes.
And so how does that work legally? Like, do they sign waivers? And I'm totally intrigued.
No, because, seriously.
Like, there is like,
we get it.
And this is like something I never get to ask about. Like
they're
you literally put electrodes in their neck and make them play a giant operation game, pulling organs out.
Yes.
How do you do that as producers?
So, I mean, they have to sign these huge waivers. I mean, it's like this thick of waivers to come on the show, you know? So we sort of protect ourselves as much as, you know, as you can really. But it's all 100% real. I mean, everything that they're doing is happening. Like, believe me, the two people that ended up jumping out of the plane on the first season, I mean, they were like shocked. Cause you got to imagine they just arrived in town a few days earlier and they start shooting and they're on set for like 18 hours a day and it's brutal. And then imagine you show up and you're like, I'm doing great. And then 2 days later, you're like, I'm about to jump out of a plane. You know what I mean? You're like, and everyone thinks I'm terrible now. So it's like, it's quite a journey, you know?
Yeah. And I have to say it creates a lot of anxiety too, like behind the wig and the glamour and the claws and all that stuff. You know, we're producing the whole thing and we're very married to a lot of what you see. Mm-hmm. So when it gets closer to the ones, like we know what exterminations are going to happen with whatever challenge. Like we know that the supervillain one, whoever performs the least, we're going to have to see them fly. And that's the mm-hmm. premise of like jumping out of the plane. So as those moments unfold, I mean, it's kind of brilliant to see who's coming ahead in the pack and who's going narrowing down. And then when we get down to like the last three or four, we're like, we know that two of these girls are going to be thrown at 18,000 feet or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
It's kind of a roller coaster working on the show, because even the producers were all sitting there and, you know, your anxiety level spiking because you're like, oh my God, I have to throw this bitch out of a plane.
Do you get and, like, nervous to, when you're about to
announce it? Oh my God, absolutely.
Wait, it's like this double-edged sword, right? It's kind of like this delicious thing because the fans really love – they really love Drac to say it too. Like, I'm delighted to tell you.
You deliver it deliciously.
So good, right?
You know what it looks is, so pleasurable
this
as you
is
guys
what
say
it is.
It, so.
I love them all, but they are all a pain in the ass. And I'm serious. They make it so difficult for us. And it's our little revenge. You know what I mean? It's a little bit to be like, give back to us a little bit, you know? So I do take some pleasure in watching them squirm. I will admit it here on live radio.
Have you guys ever felt that you went too far with any of the things that they're doing? Where you suddenly regretted it?
How far is too far?
We thought about that before because there was one in the season two opener. There was like this piercing thing,
which was crazy.
But you know, we count the type of nightlife that we used to produce. We used to do fetish clubs and all kinds of stuff. Yeah. So we're like pierced up and tattooed, mm-hmm. and like to us, it's nothing, you know. But to some people, they're like, "Oh my God, that's crazy! You're gonna kill them!" And
one of the contestants hadn't had anything tattoos, piercings, anything, and they were kind of the strongest one, actually.
Erica. So for us, I'm like, look, I've been pierced 1,000 times. You'll live. You will be fine. But of course, it looks terrifying. You know what I mean? But so we do disagree sometimes, because that day, half of the producers were like, this is crazy. Oh my God. And then the other half is like, fuck off. We did this yesterday. You know what I mean? So it's kind of like this tug of war sometimes.
Well, I would say, like, in the television landscape, when I first saw that, and I was like, oh my God, they're really doing this. And I almost picked up the phone and was like, what are you making me watch right now?
And it was like, I got from the other.
Okay, this is different than anything else I've seen on television, or Netflix for that matter.
So. We wouldn't have done that on Netflix, honestly. Like when we did season two, I knew I had our, you know, Out TV was like, yes, we can do this. So we went for it because we knew that we were like, let's get away with it while we can, because you can't. There are definitely limits, you know what I mean? And we don't want people to get hurt permanently.
I was so intrigued. I'm back to the electrodes on the neck. Like, I was so just like, can you do that? Are they going to die? Like, I was just at home.
You want to know something? Like, I put that thing on too, and that setting went to 100. But I think I got myself personally
like
to like,
six?
I think I went to like 7 or 8, and I'm like, this is going to work great. I'm like, this is going to be so good. Like, there's no way this is not going to work.
And half the producers and crew, I went around shocking them all day. So I know
it's kind of fun.
I did. I was like, put this on, Brent. He's like, okay, I'll do it. And I'll be like, can you do 14?
Oh my God.
I think we shocked our assistant too. That was kind of fun.
He's giving me the thumbs up. Yeah. But well, we have Rob and Elric here, who are fresh for the electrocution. Piercing.
Is part of the thinking of that part, besides getting revenge, is it to like place them in a position just to see how far you can push them to reveal something about themselves? Or
it's kind of like the premise is that life is like sometimes like a horror movie. Mm. And if you can't face your fears and face things that the challenge is set before you, then you're no longer worthy of the competition.
Oh, yeah.
So in that was that particular extermination was tied to the Hospital of Horrors challenge. So they needed to come up with this, like, you know, a horrifying drag image that came out of like this hospital of our twisted design, and whichever queen performed the weakest, or whichever competitor performed the weakest would have to face the extermination. But they don't know what that is until, you know, the competition has already been had. We decide the winner. Then we say, you guys are the weakest. You're up for extermination. And tonight we're going to play the live size version of Operation. And if you fail to remove all the organs, you'll be lit up with however many volts of white hot electricity to the neck.
Yeah,
that's what happened.
Is to sort of prove that you're punk rock enough of a drag artist to do these kind of things. Because like we said, the show's based off of our experience. So in our history, we've done some very crazy things on stage. So we want them to prove that they can do the same kind of stuff that the rest of the clan can, you know? Yeah. So that's really what it comes down to.
Make your freak family proud.
Also, like, you want to, you know, become this famous, like, performer. And you guys know working in the industry sucks and it's hard and it's brutal and you have to do crazy things sometimes. So I'm like, prove that you want to be here. This is your chance.
I mean,
you know?
Sometimes it really is. I mean, yes, it's exciting and, you know, drag and performing and stuff is glamorous, but it's definitely not always like that. For example, you know, we were headlining Austin Pride Festival, which happens in the summer, which happens in Texas, which happens outside. It was like 104 degrees. We're performing on stage there in like wigs, full costume, makeup, hair, nails, contact lenses, like, and it's just, you know, you're melting, but you, I mean, there's like thousands
of
people.
You gotta work it out.
Yeah, you have to work it out. You just have to perform when the time comes.
It's like Wasteland, like Wasteland Weekend.
I was so excited to see you guys went to Wasteland. I did that 5 years ago, and I only went for a day trip, but it was amazing.
It was fun, right?
It was so fun.
We've hosted that event for years before we took the show there. So that was sort of, again, it was something that we used to do that's very non-traditional for drag artists to appear in. So we wanted them to come and experience come up in the way that we did. So come and do the kind of events that we do. Go out in the desert, this crazy, like, gun Mad Max festival.
Have you guys done Wasteland
Weekend?
It is a post-apocalyptic event in the desert, and it's literally like Mad Max. Like, for a weekend, you just take over the desert. It's maybe 2 hours away from here.
Yeah, it's like the California desert,
And it's hot as fuck. Everybody's sleeping in tents, and it's all kind of, it's like a medieval weekend, but the whole thing is very Mad Max post-apocalyptic.
It's like Burning Man.
Mad Max Burning Man. That's
but these
exactly.
guys like have like gun cars retrofitted with like turrets and flamethrowers and like real guns. They go shooting and it's like, you know, it's kind of, it's like the tough kick ass post apocalyptic Burning Man.
Yeah.
And that sounds fun to me at all.
Come on, Rob, I'll take you this summer. It'll be great.
It's a big dome that you can fight people in.
The Thunderdome. Literally. Thunderdome. Yeah.
So on the episode 8 of season 2 of our show, we put them in the Thunderdome and they battle each other and it's kind of amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I covered it 5 years ago for Fangoria and they gave me a day pass and I had no idea what exactly to expect. So I like showed up looking
like
completely.
Thing,
it was. It was really fucking fun. Like, I would gladly do it again. I wish I had camped overnight.
Do you guys stay in touch with the past guests? Like, how much you stay up with what they're up to and how their lives maybe are altered or affected?
Like the competitors?
The competitors. How that community kind of grows and what they go on to do.
Yeah. You know, a lot of them live in Los Angeles or relocate here once they're on the show. Yes, unfortunately.
We're like, go back to your cities and talk about the show.
Yeah, spread it.
Don't move here. We have LA covered, you know?
Seriously. No, but we do. And then oftentimes there'll be like tours or, you know, we'll perform together when we're in their city or we'll, you know, for a few years we were running like a weekly event where we would hire a lot of performers and not just drag queens or kings, like all kinds of performers. So we'd bring them when they came to LA, we would provide them with like a stage to perform on. We're kind of like a weird little family. We definitely do stay connected.
It's hard for some of them, I think, to change the way that they see us because I think they're terrified of us when they come on the show and they only see us when we're judging them and they don't realize, like for us, we feel like we know them very well because we see them from casting through their growth and everything that's happening behind the scenes, but they just see us for like, you know, 2 hours a day and we're judging them and they're like, oh my God, you know? So I think it's hard for some of them to transition to seeing us as like just regular people.
Even other performers too, like on other television shows, they'll see us like backstage and it's like, why are they being so quiet? It's like they're just looking at us, like waiting to see what we're going to do. They're like, oh, you guys are like, y'all are like real people. Like, we can talk to you.
So what can you tell us going forward? Do we have any news about a next season or the show that's touring? Tell us where we can see everything next.
Well, the show is absolutely a fourth season is happening. We almost rushed right into production in November. Because we're sadistic, but we decided to wait because we just felt like we need some time. Like it's brutal on us. So we spent from January until November of last year pretty much 100% on the show.
Oh my gosh.
So we want some time to just like go tour a little bit, get some new inspiration and do some other things before we jump right into it. We're not interested in like mass producing content, you know? So we're going to take a little bit of time. We also, like I said, we're working on some scripted things. So, which I'm very excited, which I can't wait to tell you guys about that, but that'll be a little bit. And we are touring in Europe in the next 2 weeks. So
nice.
Yeah. We're also appearing for the Australia.
Mardi Gras. Mardi Gras. We're doing Mardi Gras. And we're doing a bunch of horror conventions, which I'm excited about too.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
We're doing one in Atlanta. I forget the name of it.
Days of the Dead. Yes. Okay. Yes. I've done their Indianapolis show before.
We'll be at Midsummer Scream, which was awesome.
So will we?
Cool.
We'll see you guys there.
Okay, yeah. And there's a possible for Monsterpalooza as well.
Mm-hmm. Fun.
Cool. Yeah. So we'll see. And I think a break will also allow us to go even more into like finding some references that we want to make sure season four is imbued with. Mm-hmm. Because we did have a break for season three. We were able to make like the mansion miniature, which was very homage to like Beetlejuice. And we did do the things for like, you know, the Halloween references and like other horror.
There was the clothesline one. There was a whole bunch of them. That's what always made me so giddy is I'd be watching and I'd be like, oh my God, she's dressed from Fascination. No one does John Rowland costumes. Yes. And it was just always kind of this beautiful tapestry of horror deep cuts in there.
It's so good to talk to people that get the references because a lot of the viewers are like fans of drag and they're like, they don't, it goes over their head and they're like, why are they doing that? And I'm like, shut up, little kid. You know, like,
I was geeking out at the top of the show about the Reanimator Herbert West one that Landon did was by far my favorite this season. It was just beautiful.
But it's probably having a break's probably also good because I think with streaming now, things are so quick to the viewer, it takes a while to catch up. And you're probably going to find there's going to be a whole new audience that takes a while to even find it once it's on Netflix, once it shows like this and people will start telling them. Yeah. So that probably will help you. You
know? Yeah, so. I think you're right. You know, because we're still feeling the effects of all those new followers kind of like rolling out. It's only been a couple of months. Excuse me. And how many comments do we get daily that's like on our social media that's just like, oh my God, I just, you know, you were recommended on my Netflix page and we just discovered this and I love you guys and my wife loves you guys. And like, you know, of course we love to see that kind of stuff. So
that's cool. Awesome.
Very cool.
Thank you so much for joining us. And we can't wait to hear about season four and your upcoming projects and everything. And thank you, ladies, so much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Now we're going to put on the electrodes, Rob.
I'm ready. Shock me.
You don't even have tattoos.
Who doesn't?
You do. You have one. Yeah. Rob doesn't have any.
I don't have any.
Every
horror
convention, we try to get Rob a tattoo. He never does.
Never going to happen.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Fangoria and Blumhouse present Shockwaves. Shockwaves is a member of the Fangoria Podcast Network, hosted and produced by Rob Galuzzo, Elric Kane, Ryan Terrick, and Rebecca McKendry. Sound recording, mixing, and editing by Ernie Hurtado. Music by Gregory S. Burkhart. Logo art and design by Aaron Crawford. For Fangoria, Dallas Danier, Phil Nobile Jr., Jessica Safa-Vamare, Brandon Wynardi, Natasha Pesetta, and Rob Galuzzo.